Hello, welcome to Cohen Esri Apartment Investors Podcast, where we talk about various topics related to the multifamily real estate world and investing in real estate. My name is Lydia Kincaid. I manage our market rate funds for CEAI, and we have Lee Harris, our president and CEO of the company. Sometimes we talk about investment opportunities, broadly speaking, and how our investors have benefited from different projects that we have seen come to fruition. We have previously been operating under Rule 506B through the Securities Act of 1933, which really prevents you from talking publicly about your offerings, or that term is called general solicitation. We've recently changed our strategy, and we're now operating under 506C, which does allow for general solicitation. So we thought now would be a great time for us to share with our audience more broadly some of our various investment opportunities that are currently open for investors. So we'll talk through several of those opportunities today. Lee, would you like to start off with a little bit of history about our acquisitions program? We could talk about BSBY strategy and then talk about these individual projects that we have currently open for new investments right now.
Over the many years since the company was formed in 1970, we have purchased a few one-off apartment properties with friends and family and country club money, let's say. But we've managed now over 78,000 apartment units for a wide range of investors, REITs, insurance companies, pension funds, banks, savings, loans, a lot of private partnerships. And in the process, we made a lot of money for clients that as they bought and sold the apartment communities that we managed. We've thought for many years that it would be a good idea perhaps to become more programmatic with our approach. And in 2006, we thought the time was right for us to really get serious about that. So we put a little team together and had some seed money and went out for 11 months looking for the right deal that fit our investment thesis, and we couldn't find it. And so we, after 11 months, put that business unit, Cohen Esri Apartment Investors, on the shelf. And the world came to an end. We had the great financial crisis in 2008, 2009. And by 2010, it became obvious that, yes, now is the right time to begin buying apartments. So on December 31, 2010, we closed our first two acquisitions. One was a 76-unit high-rise historic building in the central west end of St. Louis, and the other was a 150-unit garden-style property in Louisville, Kentucky. And then for the next 3 or 4 years after that, we were buying mainly smaller properties, many of which we had managed. Some had been in the affordable housing tax credit program, and we were taking those to market rate after their compliance period ended. And we were doing this again with country club money, friends and family money, but realized that this really isn't a scalable type of adventure. So in 2015, we launched what we call version 2.0 of our strategy to bring serious program equity into the mix. And we refined our investment thesis well to do that. Since then, actually since 2011, we purchased 32 properties in 13 states, about 10,000 units at a cost of $1.14 billion. So we've gotten fairly serious, as you can tell, with this approach. The real difference here is that we are working now with a series of investors who are institutional and sophisticated, let's put it that way. We have a large multifamily office that aggregates the investments for 11 families. We've had a relationship with them since 1991. And I believe of those 18, or those 32 properties, 18 of those acquisitions have come through that that family office. We've also worked with some other institutional type of investors that are the LPs in our partnerships. And what we do is we bring that program equity into a 200 to 600 unit apartment community. 350 units is kind of the sweet spot. And that LP equity comprises 90% of the equity stack. So if it's a $30 million equity component of a, say, $70 million transaction, $27 million of that's going to come from the LP, family office, insurance company, whoever our partner is. And the other 10% is going to come from a co-investment piece that we syndicate through a series of co-investment funds. This has worked pretty darn well for us over the years. We've been acquiring now with this investment piece is pretty much the same type of property where version 1.0, we were kind of buying a hodgepodge, but now we're much more disciplined in the approach that we take. So that's kind of the history of where we've been and where we are today.
Well, and you mentioned the co-investment piece of this, Lee. We created a co-investment fund in 2016, and we named that first programmatic fund CEAI Fund 23. It was the 23rd fund, even though the prior funds were more one-off properties, as you described. It was the 23rd in our series of funds that we had launched. That fund had around 35 investors total in there who participated in that offering. And so they owned a piece of that co-investment equity portion of all of the properties in that fund. There were 13 in total. And we've sold, like, 7 or 8 of those so far. And we generated a great IRR, around 20% IRR, just based on those sales to date. We have several more left to sell over the next year or so. So those investors have been very happy. They have reinvested in Fund 24, which is our next programmatic fund that we launched just a couple of years ago. That fund is fully subscribed from investors, and so we are actively deploying capital from that fund. It's almost fully deployed. In fact, we just have room for 1 or 2 more properties, depending on the size, that'll fit into that fund. So we have recently launched Fund 25. So it's our third major programmatic fund following the same investment thesis that we've been following all this time, pursuing the best B approach to properties that we acquire and manage and then eventually sell. The size of those funds has increased over time as well. Fund 23 was about $13.75 million. Fund 24, $26.5 million. Fund 25, our current offering, is also raising $26.5 million. We've raised about $10 million of that so far. Across these funds, we are still exclusively accepting accredited investors as defined by the SEC as well. But our investors have really enjoyed the diversification aspect of these funds. There's various properties, but various vintages within the properties that we buy. So different years that those properties were built, different timelines of our renovation program, different geographies as well. We do like to create economies of scale in different pockets of geographies, but this is not just all based in one suburb or one city. This is really nice diversification option for investors. Lee, would you like to start as we talk more about the best B strategy and how this has really benefited our investors in those funds?
Sure. The best B is the tip of the hat to Class B apartments. And how do we define Class B? Principally by age. We're looking at garden-style properties for the most part, built in the 1990s, clear up to 2018. We target, as I said before, properties 200 to 600 units. We have a 601 unit property in the portfolio right now. We had a 612 unit property that we sold, but 350 units is kind of the sweet spot. It gives you the right size for economies and efficiencies where staffing is concerned and other efficiencies that we're looking for from a management standpoint. We target the top 100 markets by population and eliminate the Northeast and the West Coast. Those markets don't really align with our investment thesis. There's some regulatory environment issues that we don't like. So we're now down to 51 markets based on the population. Then we look at the population growth, we look at job growth, we look at Class B rent growth, and we're looking back 5 years and forward 5 years with certain metrics in mind to winnow down these markets even further. Population growth, job growth, Class B rent growth, and the markets that we consider have to make the metric in at least two of those three areas. Some markets make all three. Some markets only make one, and we don't look at that market for the next year. Then we drill into the markets that meet our requirements and look further at specific submarkets. And particularly, we're looking at the quality of schools, we're looking at crime statistics, household incomes, that sort of thing. And we need to find an asset that can be acquired at least 25% below replacement cost. So that's another one of our thresholding requirements. And markets that currently make the cut are in Florida, Jacksonville, Orlando, Tampa, St. Petersburg, Fort Myers, Sarasota, Bradenton, Naples, Atlanta, Charlotte, Columbus, Ohio, Indianapolis, Louisville, and Lexington, Kentucky. Kansas City's a good market. That's our headquarters market. Denver, Colorado Springs, Nashville, Houston, Dallas, the whole Dallas Metroplex, actually, San Antonio, Austin, et cetera. So there's quite a few large markets that fit the bill. We do avoid properties in hurricane surge zones. So in Florida and Houston, we need to buy inland enough that we avoid the surge. We spend about $3,000 to $10,000 per unit to make physical improvements. It's perhaps an exterior refresh. Maybe there's some additional amenities that we add, and certainly we do unit interior upgrades. The goal then is to create what we call the best B product. So it really has all the features of a Class A property, but at hundreds of dollars less per month in rent. Now, we're not going to turn an 8-foot ceiling into a 9-foot ceiling like they might have in a Class A property, a new property, but most people like the fact that our properties are laden with amenities, they get great service, and they might pay $400, $500, $600 a month less in rent than that Class A property down the street. Another thing we do is underwrite the exit in a very, very conservative way. We have to see a similar quality asset, similar vintage, quality, et cetera, that is sold today at the same price point per unit we're looking at 5 years down the road, which is our typical holding period. So if we buy a property, let's say, for $135,000 a unit, and we're programming it to sell for $175,000 a unit, we need to see something of similar construction, age, et cetera, that has sold today in that $175,000 range. We'll sweat a little. It's $169,000, okay. But if it's $150,000 today, then we won't pursue that property. And that's knocked down a lot of opportunities for us. But it's just another margin of safety that we bring to bear here. We also are looking at not just selling everything after 5 years. One of our investors has a 7-year holding period. One of our LPs. But instead, if the asset's really a good asset, we want to recapitalize it, which means at the end of that holding period, we're going to bring in new debt, new equity. And the whole idea is if you have a great asset to begin with, why let go of it? So what we do is we get a couple of MAI appraisals and make sure that we're treating our existing investors fairly, as well as new investors fairly, to get an honest appraisal of what that market value should be. Returns we're looking for in the mid to high teens. That's really hard to get today. So we haven't bought much. We bought one property, a 323 unit property in Jacksonville, Florida this year, and we closed one origination that happened in 2022. 260 units in Lenexa, Kansas, part of our Kansas City metro. We made a best and final on a deal in a Florida market recently. And that was a good thing. But when we submitted our final bid, we learned that we lost by $3 million, which somebody bought that in serious negative leverage and probably take a return in the 10% range, which is not very good in this current environment. And lastly, leverage. We are not high leverage folks. So you've noticed, as I've said throughout this conversation, that we have margins of safety and leverage. Our current portfolio is only leveraged 63% loan to cost. So we're not 85-90%, which would help the returns, by the way, but it puts a whole lot more risk into play.
That's right. And Lee, you mentioned Park Edge. So I shared that Fund 25, our most recent programmatic fund, is open to investors. Let's talk about Park Edge, because we have some pretty unique offerings associated with that property that we acquired last August. That property had a pretty unique capitalization stack. It required a lot of equity. And so we've been creative in thinking through ways to bring in different options for investors to participate. Of course, Fund 25 and also Fund 24 participated on the co-invest side. We also created a note program that investors participated in, and that program is still open today as well. There's an 8% guaranteed return entity that we've created, so investors don't actually sign a note. The entity did. Investors will receive quarterly distributions that equate to an 8% annualized return. And we've also enabled that entity to receive an allocation of depreciation. A lot of investors have asked us about depreciation, so we've created a carve-out for that specific entity as well. So those investors will enjoy the benefit of a guaranteed return and also a depreciation allocation as well. So Lee, do you want to talk about that entity and also the new entity we've created that creates a pref position within the management entity?
Yeah, let me go a little higher level first and talk about fundraising generally. Since 2011, we've raised $400 million in LP equity to date. So that's a fairly significant amount of money. We're not a huge operation, but we're not small by any stretch either. And that $400 million is what I referenced earlier as the LP 90% equity. And then so far, we've raised $50 million in this co-investment equity space through Fund 23, Fund 24, and Fund 25. That's the 10% piece. And what we found that it's necessary in this environment is to get very creative, as you pointed out. In the case of Park Edge, the 260 units in Lenexa, Kansas, there's a great story with that property. We managed that property for the Los Angeles County Employees Retirement Association for several years, sometime back. And then the property was sold. And after that holding period ended, and that particular buyer was ready to sell the property, we stepped up because we knew the asset extremely well. It's an extraordinary location in an area that is blowing up. I mean, it's just exploding with population and jobs and the whole, everything you're looking for, household incomes in the area, school districts. And so we acquired that asset last August. The LP at the fairly last moment adjusted the amount. Rather than put in 90%, they put in a little more than 50% of the equity need. And that was because they had some internal issues that they were dealing with, had no bearing on this property or our relationship with them. It was totally unrelated. So they put up $15 million of equity, and I believe the total capital stack equity-wise needed $29 million, something like that. So we put Fund 24 in, Fund 25 in, as you suggested. And then we bridged the remaining $10 million or so. We have since had the bridge note program in place. And currently, we're looking at raising $7 million to pay off the bridge or some portion of the bridge. The preferred equity, so some of the prospective investors said, well, we're really not inclined to do an 8% guaranteed return, we'd like to see more upside. So we thought, okay, we'll create another tranche here, which is an investment in CEI Park Edge Investor that owns a good chunk of this equity. And we will cap that return at 14% on a preferred basis. Now, what does that mean? It's preferred to the extent that the investor gets their money back and they get the 14% internal rate of return, annual return, before we, as the sponsor, get a nickel. And that's really important to understand, because sometimes there's a pari passu kind of relationship here with the equity partners. And in this case, we're saying, nope, we're going to make sure that our co-investment partners receive all their money back and a 14% return before we participate in any of the upside. So that is currently an offering. Again, you pointed out accredited investors only, and a quick definition, an accredited investor is somebody that the SEC considers having earned income of $200,000 for each of the last 2 years, or $300,000 if it's a couple, and they have an expectation that they'll be in that same vicinity for the current year, or they have a net worth of $1 million exclusive of their primary residence. So and one other note here, there's a requirement under 506C that we verify accreditation, but that's a really simple thing, because there's a templated letter that we provide that an investor can give to their attorney, to their tax preparer, to their securities broker. It's a single pager, and it's not intrusive. It's just requiring some third party to verify that this investor is in fact accredited. And that's an SEC requirement. So, as I said, there's really, for Park Edge, there's two opportunities. There's a preferred equity opportunity. There is also the 8% guaranteed opportunity. And there's also CEAI Fund 25, which still needs to raise another $16.5 million or so. That's the opportunity for an investor to play the field, so to speak. They get the benefit of multiple markets. We will deploy that capital over the next 18, 24, maybe even takes 30 months to find the properties that we want to buy that I described earlier, the best BEAT product that we're looking for. But there's one difference too with Fund 25, and that is that we're calling for capital as we need it to invest in these properties. Fund 23, Fund 24, the capital was raised up front, but that's because we had a myriad of opportunities for investment. Now that it's slower, it makes no sense to take an investor's money up front and then sit on that money with the rate of return clock already ticking. So we call for capital as we need it. Those are the opportunities that we have. There is a fourth opportunity that I'm going to mention, and that is through our development unit. Typically, we do not invest our co-investment funds in development deals, ground-up construction. This is a unique situation in San Marcos, Texas. It's a 233-unit workforce housing opportunity. And it's a boom town. You're on the I-35 corridor between San Antonio and Austin. It's part of the Austin Metro. Population grew from about 45,000 to almost 68,000 over 10 years from 2010 to 2020. And again, that whole corridor is just on fire. So there's a slice of equity there, about $6 million that we're raising. The projected IRR is 26.4%, and the targeted equity return multiple is 3.18, which is huge. This is a public facilities corporation project there's a combination of 50% market rate, and 50% of the units are rented to residents and 80% of the area median income. The distinction here is we are not going to have any Fund 25 investors or investors in this particular product at risk until the property is constructed and leased up and stabilized. And one of the reasons we're putting this in Fund 25 is because that kind of a return, outsized return, helps the overall weighted return for the fund. So that is another opportunity, both through Fund 25 and through a special purpose entity that we're creating for that $6 million tranche. So those are the opportunities.
Lee, when do you expect the San Marcos opportunity to be live?
We expect it to be, we'll close that partnership sometime October-ish, November of this year.
Okay,
and
great.
Start construction shortly thereafter.
So for investors listening, you might be listening on the go as well. I will make sure to include my email address and phone number in the summary that we provide of this podcast so you can reach out to me directly on any of these opportunities that we've discussed today. We'd be happy to answer any of your questions, and provide further information about any of these open opportunities. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and we will talk to you next time.